Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Nina.
How are you? Another podcast coming up.
Another podcast. Here we go.
Okay, so today I wanted to make it easier on both us and listeners, and none of the very sophisticated topics. I was thinking that maybe we should do something that works well with long November nights, when it's dark and you cannot go out and the weather is bad and there's so many hours to kill, and talk about our favorite, I called it sagas on screen, meaning TV shows or maybe series of movies that are spanning a lot of either time or space, and they are many episodes, and they talk about the history of a family or a country or some kind of a long period of time, and have some values that appeal to us either intellectually or emotionally, or talk about some aspects of economic or political or history and potential implications for our current life. But the most important factor here should be whether they are extremely watchable for many, many, many episodes. So with that introduction, I think we could use the format that kind of works for us. And that means that you choose several of those long sagas that you like, and then we can alternate with mine and we can see what we recommend.
Okay.
So you go.
Well, as you know, I have many that I love, but I would say contending three that are my all-time favorite. And the first was shocking to me, and that was Battlestar Galactica. And I need to tell you the story of how I first saw it. I had an intern who came and worked with me in Hickory Valley who was a Mormon. And it was written, Battlestar Galactica was the science fiction, was first written by Glenn Larson, who I believe was a Mormon or knew the Book of Mormon. And so there was a sort of a Mormon connection. Mm-hmm. But it had been a movie, and then it was made, well, it was made into a, I guess, a TV series and then a movie. And then a new TV series in 2004 to 2009. So as you can imagine, 2004 to 2009, 5 years, plus they did a prequel, I think they call it. And so it's a lot of shows. Anyway, so David kept trying to persuade me to watch this. And I kept thinking, why would I want to watch, you know, 5 seasons of a bunch of sort of people in a spaceship looking for a planet to live on? Anyway, so he persuaded me to try one and I was hooked. I absolutely loved it. And I never, ever...
Well, then you have to tell me why, because science fiction and Catherine, that's interesting. Tell us.
So the spaceship that survives an attack, you're in a universe where there is a war between the Cylons, which are essentially robots that pass for humans, and the human race. And the Cylons just decide to genocide the human race. Mm-hmm. And the one spaceship and sort of part of the military that's able to survive are the ones that have all the old clunky technology, so the robots and the AI can't sabotage it. Anyway, so it starts off with reaffirming my lack of faith in digital systems. and the
Are you saying that the ship runs on analog?
Right, and it's how important it is to not integrate everything with everything, or else you can make yourself very vulnerable. So the beauty of the story is you have a military commander who is played by, you know his name, he's a very famous actor. What is it?
Wow.
It's James Olmos. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
And then Mary McConnell plays the, at the time of the attack, She's, I think, 37th in line for the presidency. She's the head of the educational cabinet, and everyone else is killed, so she becomes the president. Anyway, so you have the political leader, and you have the military leader, and there's this constant he said, she said, you know, sort of male, female, military versus civil leadership dynamic between the two of them. And in the process, it explores all the issues of leadership.
Ah, that's interesting.
Right. It's completely Shakespearean. There's this one of my favorite scenes. So Almost plays a commander named Adama. And there's this scene where he's in one of the initial battles where they're battling with the Cylons after they've pretty much decimated their planet. And he has a fight with the president who's trying to get him to do one thing in particular. And he says, you know, he turns to him and he says, I don't know if you notice, but I'm commanding, you know, an army at war. And she looks at him and she says, Commander, we've lost the war. Now we need to run away and make babies. And he's stunned, like he's slapped in the face, and he realizes she's right. You know, so you have these magical moments that go back and forth between military and civilian, between government and military, between man and woman, and it goes on and on and on. And all the struggles of managing a population in a situation where, you know, they're in danger of being wiped out. So there's significant danger. So off they go looking for a planet. And the goal is to ultimately find Earth. Anyway, it goes 5 seasons, and it really explores issues of AI and robotics. It really explores issues of leadership when you're dealing with phenomenal and invisible technology. And it's very prescient. And the acting is fantastic. I absolutely loved it. I was hooked. I was like an addiction.
Now, I can see why, but since there are 2 series, are you referring to the original one, or is the second TV series also worth watching? Because sometimes when they do a remake, this is not so great, and sometimes it's even better, so it depends. Like Star Trek is very complex.
Okay, so I thought it was the one with Almost.
James, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and McDonald. So that it was.
So the first, the original series.
Well, the first, I mean, I think of the original as being the 78-79. So Battlestar Galactica was a TV series in 78.
Oh.
And then there were 19.
You don't mean that one.
No. And there were 1980 episodes. But I mean the one that occurred, I don't know, it was the.
Okay. So the one that.
Yeah, it was in the 2000s. So it was.
In the 2000s, okay.
Yeah.
So that's the one that we should look at. Well, I mean, it's an old truth that obviously science fiction is often used to say something about a society when, for whatever reason, sometimes just the entertainment reason, but other reasons, when you don't say anything about the contemporary society. There was a science fiction writer called Stanisław Lem. He lived in Poland during the Stalinist era, and obviously he could not talk about communist Stalin, Russia, or anything that was contemporary, because he would end up in a concentration camp or killed. So he did science fiction at the time that science fiction was starting out, if you like, the modern science fiction, the 1950s is the golden age of a lot of science fiction writers. But Lem, as opposed to Arthur C. Clarke or any of the giants of the science fiction literature, was kind of stuck and locked up in behind the Iron Curtain. So for him, that was the only way that he could say something about the society. And he wrote the most amazing classic novels. Anybody who is into science fiction literature knows Stanisław Lem. It's L-E-M is his last name. Because he was writing the novels that are still very, very famous and popular. So for him, writing science fiction was the way to talk about, you know, contemporary society, that he would not say anything outright. But what you're saying about Battlestar Galactica is that this is the way to do in an entertaining medium or genre of science fiction, a story or an analysis of various problems of the society that we have now, right?
Right. And it's interesting because oftentimes when you talk with people in America, they have very little understanding of what it's like to manage being in a senior government or a position with significant resource responsibility. And there's theater and great TV shows that really teach you, that really show you what it's like to be in those positions. And this is one of them. You know, interestingly enough, one that was very popular at the Salieri Report, which I promoted heavily, was Borgen, the Danish show about the prime minister. And, you know, that's another example. But Battlestar Galactica really helps you understand what being in a major leadership position dealing with real risk is like and what it feels like.
That's really an outlier, but it's a very fascinating outlier. By the way, about Borgen, you've been recommending that show for at least 3 years that I can recall, and now it is a very hot show on Netflix. And I'm just looking, it's like, didn't Solari recommend it 3 years ago? It's like, really, seriously, people.
We have one subscriber who says, if you want to know what's hot, you know, a year beforehand, or if you want to know what's going to be in 60 minutes, you know, 6 months before it's on, subscribe to Salieri.
I mean, seriously, yeah.
So we're kind of the reporter's reporter. A lot of reporters read our stuff. So a lot of reporters read your stuff.
Yes, yeah, so I noticed. We noticed a few articles that seem to have been kind of spawned out of whatever we covered. But let's go to next show. And I would choose something that is, I tend to go for historical stuff, as you know, but the one that everybody has probably seen it, or quite a lot of people have seen it, but I think it's just very timely. I'm thinking of Downton Abbey, that most people have seen it, or a lot of people would have seen it. There was a TV show that ran for, I think, 6 seasons, plus there was a movie at the end of it, just to kind of create a feature film for those who were still fan of the show when the show ended. For those who haven't seen it, which I think would be very few people, this is basically happening at the first quarter of the 20th century. So starts with the sinking of the Titanic, which I think is 1912 or 1913, just before the First World War, and it goes as late 1920s. It's a story of an aristocratic family called Crawleys, who have a large family house called Downton Abbey, and the story of that family and of all their servants. So it's kind of upstairs, downstairs situation. Both worlds kind of interact daily because they form one big household, but at the same time, they have different problems and challenges. There's a lot of going back and forth between them in terms of their intertwined fate. It tries to be very realistic in terms of problems that it tackles, the position of women in the society, the attempts of their emancipation, the problems of servants whose employment is entirely dependent on the goodwill of their employer, and if for whatever reason they are cast out from that employment without references, then the chances of next employment are very small. So everybody is extremely interdependent. And then they go into the First World War. And I wanted to talk about one episode, which I think is in season 2, which actually deals with the pandemic. So I think it's very timely. Did you want to say something?
I love Downton Abbey. You know, that was one where I don't think of myself as a binge watcher, but when the next season of Downton Abbey would come out, I think it would usually, a couple times it came out during the holidays, so you you really could do a binge watch if you wanted. And I just loved it. Among other things, it showed you, you know, so you have this human ecosystem, and it just shows you what happens. They spend a lot of time deciding whether or not to let somebody in their circle. And it just goes to show you how expensive it is when you let a bad dog into your circle. So you have a butler who's always causing trouble, making trouble, and he finally comes around. But, you know, in the five seasons, he does a lot of damage and wrecks a lot of stuff. Anyway, but
The principle of writing is only negative characters move the action forward.
Really?
So we need him. And he's very handsome and very wicked, so it's very helpful. But I was attracted to a lot of things. The realism of, you know, what it takes to, you know, put together a party or, you know, run a household, you know, where you have tenants and the farms and, you know, the economics of it, which I'm sure that you have been observing.
Uh-huh.
Actually, do you want to comment to that? You know, that they spent a lot of time on economics of, you know, how you keep this household going when all the others are kind of falling apart around them.
Right, because it becomes prohibitively expensive to run it. And the question is, how are you going to make the land sweat for you? And then how do you adapt? Because so much of the wealth is now being created off the land. It's industrial or new technology. It's very similar dynamics to what we see now. So, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is very interesting because on one hand, they are legally prevented from selling off the land because these are the laws in England of inheritance of all those great estates. So they cannot kind of chop it up and sell it develop into little parcels. But on the other hand, this is 1910 and 1920, and there is technological change, and they need to catch up, which they do in ingenious ways. Like the two of them, for example, on that estate, they set up a garage and they start buying and selling cars. You know, they set up a car dealership. This is 1920. That's very ingenious. There is Lady Mary who, you know, who runs a piggery, right?
Right.
Because she has the land and she's not afraid of, you know, it's not beneath her. She's just going to have, you know, a pig farm, which I find fascinating. And of course, there's all those delicious, you know, plots and subplots and kind of a history of social changes. There is an episode there. This is at the end of, towards the end of the First World War, and it's 1918. And there are several members of the household who get sick with the Spanish flu. A couple of servants, the lady of the manor, Cora Crawley, who is the wife of the lord of the manor, if you like. And there is a young fiancé who is about to get married of the heir to the estate. And they show that the older people, like the old butler, for example, they do get very, very sick, but then they recover. And then the person who should recover right away, which is this maybe 20-year-old lady, I hope that I'm not spoiling anything, but that's what happens. She's not able to overcome the virus because that's how it was. The Spanish flu was very characteristic that it basically attacked the young and spared the older people, probably because of the antibodies or whatever the reason was, and how swift it is and how devastating. It's a very fascinating episode to watch in 2020, I would say.
Right.
And of course, the complete lack, I mean, what they have in terms of medicine is pathetic. All they have is bandages and compresses and the kind words to everybody who comes maimed from the war and sick with flu. They just basically had absolutely nothing to work with, you know, not even an aspirin, I think. So that's an interesting episode to watch. But otherwise, it's exactly as you say, that this is extremely bingeable, as in, you know, you start watching and it's addictive because you just want to say what happens in the next episode to all these people who are constantly having some dramas that you would never even suspect.
Right.
So that's the, because it's just pure entertainment, I would say. What is your next choice?
So my next choice was movie of the year last year on the Solari Report, and that is Yellowstone, which had finished its second season when I made it movie of the year, and now it's had a third season, which I've watched. And it's the story, It's in Montana, so it's in a part of the world that I've lived in and I love, the beauty of the Big Sky Country. And it's written by a fellow named Taylor Sheridan, who I think is just an absolute genius in terms of seeing into the human condition and scripting it in a drama. It's just quite amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Kevin Costner plays the patriarch of a family who's been on this land for several generations, and he's trying to preserve what is the biggest landholding in Montana. He has a personal relationship with the governor, who's constantly conflicted between lobbyists who are lobbying to change the rules so they can grab his land and him trying to preserve it. And so much of it is about property rights and family rights. And of course, the family has a bad seed. So you get the challenges of the good seed, the bad seed. And you see, so historically, the biggest investment families make are in having and raising and educating their children. And if you look at the economics of America, one of the biggest reasons for the failure on Main Street is the kids don't stay. You know, you educate and raise them, and then they go off and work for the large companies that are trying to take away your business. So you very much see the economics to the family and the family's holdings of the young people coming up and whether they help or whether they hurt. It's very interesting to watch. And I recommended it as movie of the year because one of the critical parts of the drama is you have these two players in Montana called the Beck brothers. And the Beck brothers do all the dirty tricks. They cheat, they steal, they lie. You know, they're nothing but, you know, they're basically organized crime.
Now, is this contemporary as in, you know, all happens now in 21st century?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely 21st century. It's totally now. And the Beck brothers are moving in and trying to grab land, and they're willing to poison your cattle and kidnap your grandchildren, and they hire mercenaries who run around and kill people. They're very dangerous guys. And I said at the beginning of the year when I reviewed Yellowstone that the question before us in 2020 was, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers? And there's this great scene where one of the sons who's been a special forces soldier is designated as the guy who's got to go kill. They decide, okay, you can't get along with the Beck brothers. We're going to have to take him out, but we have to take him out in a way where we don't, you know, get nailed and go to prison. So they figure it all out. Anyway, the special forces soldier heads up to take out one of the Beck brothers who's sitting in the toilet, not expecting him. And so his son has just been kidnapped by the Beck brothers. And he says to the guy, why did you put us in the position? Why did you put us in a position where we have to kill you? And the guy sitting on the toilet, he says, nobody ever fights back.
Ah.
And the kid says, well, we do, and shoots him and kills him. So I said that, you know, the issue is, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers? And recommended Yellowstone. Because I think it's back to Shakespearean. I have read and watched all of Shakespeare's plays performed. I just love Shakespeare because I think Shakespeare, you know, gets into all the big issues and does it brilliantly. So I recommended it. And several subscribers were furious with me because they came back and they said, we started to watch it and it's so violent. And I want to warn everybody, there's a lot of violence in Yellowstone. It is very violent.
Like the world is not violent. They should spend an afternoon in Los Angeles. Or Chicago.
Well, but here's the thing. Many of us in America have been very protected from the violent. Now, I grew up in a poor neighborhood and I saw a lot of violence early. And the nature of my life, when you litigate with the U.S. Department of Justice, you run into a lot of... So I've run into a lot of violence and dealt with a lot of violence in my life. But I realized when they came back and said that they're, you know, they're absolutely... sort of these bubbles in America of people who really don't deal with violence. And so be warned that it is very violent, but this is the violence of America.
Yeah, exactly.
And the violence, you know, I've lived with and I've seen other people live with. And if you're in LA, you certainly know about it. So be warned, because our world is about to get a lot more, you know, is getting a lot more violence. The sort of bubbles are coming down. Anyway, but
I mean, the world is extremely violent outside America. You know, you live in Paris and you learn about it in about 5 seconds flat.
Right. So Yellowstone is, and a lot of it goes to the issues of, is an individual sovereign and are their property rights sovereign, or does the world have the right to show up and use politics to take it away? And it explores all of these issues around the family saga. You know, to me, those are the best sagas, the family sagas. And that's clearly what Downton Abbey is. And that's what Yellowstone is. And in Battlestar Galactica, you see people struggling to recreate or to have families under the most brutal circumstances.
Right. I mean, that's why we call them sagas, because we want to look at some people over the time and, you know, various characters that we obviously then hopefully see get attached. And that's what's where the binge watching comes from. But and I have another one that, like, it's an example of a family saga. I think I talked about this TV show for sure in some recommendations. And that show is based on books. And in my opinion, the books are far superior than the TV show, incomparably. But if someone just wants to watch rather than read hundreds of pages, then the show is probably the way to go. The show is ongoing, called The Outlander. I think there are 5 episodes already available, and the 6th, I'm not sure, which have this twist of a time travel, but it's actually allowing us, it's kind of like a device that allows us to go into the 18th century, which for at least 2 parts of the world are pivotal political moments. The premise is that there is a nurse who in 1945 accidentally walks through the Stonehenge stones to a period of 200 years earlier, to the Scotland of around 1745, which is the time where Scotland has lost its independence after the Battle of Culloden. The nurse is married, but obviously she's now stuck 200 years earlier and is forced into a marriage to a Scottish nobleman, if you like, for various circumstances, and then goes with him. They fall in love. She goes with him through Scottish attempts at regaining independence, the support of Bonnie Prince Charlie, all the battles that happened around the 1740s that have ended up in Scottish defeat and the destruction of Scottish clans. She, in the meantime, goes back to early 1960s, raises a child, becomes a doctor. And that all this is happening in 1960s Boston, Massachusetts, in the States. In further episodes, she goes back again to first Scotland and then what is America just prior to the American Revolutionary War.
Wow.
So this device allows you to be looking for a brief moment into, you know, 20th century world, if you like, just because we need some anchor for us. But then it allows you to look at both Scotland and America, not United States then, yeah, it's just America, in the 18th century, at the moments of, you know, one country loses its independence, meaning Scotland, and the other country gains it, meaning America. It is full, it is a family saga because there are various members of the family that go back and forth. And it is a great panorama of everything from what was the medicine in 18th century, because she's a doctor, but obviously in 18th century is something different than in the 20th. The panorama of political forces, you know, there's England, France, Scotland, and America and Canada, or what became later Canada, involved in various configurations of the political and economic fight. And at the same time, obviously, you have the characters that have their own arc of development and changes and ups and downs and dramas and love and romance and whatever else you would like to have. So you can't really ask for anything better. Are you familiar with this, with Outlander?
You know, I've tried to watch Outlander several times and gotten interrupted because there are parts which are absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. And then there are other parts which are just, you just don't want to live through that. So, but I've never sat down and tried to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
And part of it is that if you look at how many episodes there are, it's really daunting.
Well, Diana Gabaldon, who is the author of the novels and an absolutely brilliant one, I think she's an American writer who lives in Arizona, is absolutely brilliant because she is not Scots and she is not English and she hasn't lived in 18th century anything because she lives now. And her books are absolutely fascinating. She wrote about 8 or 9, I want to say, by now, in the same world. And the books are, each novel is, I don't know, 600 pages at least. And they are full of details of, I don't know, life in a plantation in Virginia or North Carolina during the slavery and everything that it entails. Or the life in the Scottish Highlands in 1700s, and so on and so on. So they're extremely well-researched, beautifully described, with great psychological insight. The show, unfortunately, flattens all of this in favor of, you know, some romance scenes and clothing and whatever, just because it is a TV show, and TV show is not going to delve into the Bergman-esque psychological motivations. But the books are fantastic, so I would suggest that maybe you could get into this world through books, the way I did it years ago. And then the show is more watchable, if you like. Mm-hmm. I mean, the show is still entertaining and watchable, but you don't get this vast wealth of information that you get from out of books, like with every book, right? Almost every book. But I would highly recommend it to anybody who likes history.
Right.
And kind of, it's almost like, what was the everyday life in those years, you know? That's probably the way to describe it. You know, it's like the daily life in, you know, I don't know, 17th century Scotland. That's probably interesting.
Yes, I don't know.
So that was my choice. What was your next title?
So my next one was recommended by a subscriber, I think 2 years ago. And when they recommended it, I thought, oh, it's, you know, I can't believe I'm going to enjoy this. Mm-hmm. It's called Mr. Sunshine. And it had been the most popular TV show in Korea, or TV series in Korea. And it's a love story set in the years when Korea is still trying to emerge as a country. And I just thought, how could, you know, this one's going to be kind of a leap. Anyway, I started to watch it and I couldn't stop. It was, first of all, the cinematography is so beautiful. It's extraordinary. And the lead actors and actresses are outstanding. But it's, how do I describe it? It describes a romance in a world that is under tremendous stress and pressure, but where relationships are not, how can I say? Relationships between man and woman are much more chaperoned and careful. Mm-hmm. So it's in a much older time. And so the evolution of this love story is quite detailed and slow and careful and full of suspense. And the combination of the love story with the beauty of the cinematography. And of course, we're back to great issues, the great issues of the day.
So let me interrupt you for a second. Well, there's two things to that show because it's one of the shows I recommended in one of the lists, so I'm also familiar. And we are very grateful eternally to one of the subscribers who has suggested that. Because even though this show runs, I think, on Netflix or one of those platforms, it is called Mr. Sunshine in the English version, which is obviously absurd because it sounds like, you know, maybe a Broadway show or something.
It does.
And this is hardly that because it is set in the very last decade of the 19th century when Korea is, as you say, trying to emerge as a country from the feudal system of, you know, the feudal absolutist ruler. And there is both the Japanese, Japan and United States that are stationed in and around Korea trying to take over that, you know, very tasty morsel of the Asian land,
right,
so to speak.
Right.
So Korea needs to, at the same time, transform itself from the feudal country to the modern society with the president and more or less capitalistic or, you know, technologically advanced economy. And at the same time, is fighting off superpowers like Japan and the United States. So this is the setting of it, which is also amazing because I don't know about you, but I knew something about Korea, but I didn't know that much, not about the U.S. Army there.
I didn't know about the U.S. Army. I did not know a lot about Korea before I watched it. I do know a lot about different countries, you know, trying to assert and interfere with sovereignty. So it's a perfect example of the, you know, of the local population trying to create the conditions of national sovereignty, mm-hmm, while you have all these different foreigners running around and trying to exploit, divide and conquer, you know, make, in a funny kind of way, there's not a county on the planet that's not struggling with these issues right now. Whether they're struggling with the issues that you see in Yellowstone or the issues you see in Mr. Sunshine. And the question is, you know, how does the population manage to succeed together, you know, dealing with all these forces? Because they're truly outpowered.
Right. So that's why we're recommending this TV show, because A, it talks about the culture that most of the Western viewers are not very familiar with, but at the same time, it has such a misleading title, so it's easy to miss it as some kind of romance drama or, you know, a comedy. Literally, it sounds to me like a Broadway show, and it's hardly that, you know? It's political, it's intense, I don't know.
Why did they not come up with a different name for the American or for the English version?
Anything slightly kind of defiantly military would sound better, you know, I don't. Defying Dragons or whatever would be more appropriate than Mr. Sunshine. It's literally about the fight, right, for sovereignty. You know, yes, there's a romance so that it would be something for you to watch, but hell, this is tough stuff there. You know, this is not a romance at all. I mean, there is a romance, but this is not all about that. So I'm very glad that you recommended that, because I actually forgot about this show, mm-hmm, how good it is and how worth recommending it is. And it's long, so, you know, you can binge.
So what I'm wondering is if the people who made Mr. Sunshine have done something else that has translated to the West.
Well, Korean TV shows are very good. There's a lot of them. I watched several of them, quite a lot of them. You know, the crime shows, their crime shows are very sophisticated and, funny enough, very often remade in the United States under some completely different title, you know, just taking the plot, uh-huh, and casting with the American cast and not even mentioning that they are actually remakes of something Korean. And obviously with Parasite, you know, Korean cinema is having a great run in the international scene as well. So Korean cinema is wonderful, but, you know, we are kind of dependent on what comes to our streaming platforms here and gets translated. So there could be lots of stuff that we never get to see. Usually the crime shows are shown here and they are pretty good, but not that many historical ones other than, you know, the ones that, like the Chinese shows, those kind of sagas that happen at the, you know, Middle Ages imperial courts, you know, the dramas of the courtesans and the emperors and stuff like this. But it's definitely worth exploring, I would say.
Well, I think what you see happening, and in your columns on the movies, you see this as well. We're watching this explosion of movie talent around the world in other countries that traditionally we didn't have access to. And I'm thinking of the amazing things that have been coming out of Denmark or the things like Mr. Sunshine coming out of Korea. But now if the streamers make it available, then we find out about it. And then it goes. You were just talking about how when I first discovered Borgen, promoted it very heavily on the Solari Report, you were saying, how many years later was it when it became sort of common knowledge and popular?
About 3 years. 3 years.
About 3 years, yeah. So it takes time for these things to make it through the streaming and into the, you know, sort of to go viral, but they do. And I expect that to continue to happen more and more.
Well, from the industry point of view, it's definitely going to continue because this is, you know, so-called Netflix effect, if you like, meaning the streamers and, you know, there's so many platforms of them now because everybody wants a piece of that pie and theatrical business is in complete disarray. So they are hungry for the intellectual property, for the shows to show, in other words.
Right.
And one of the sources, there's two sources. One is to produce the local stuff, but because of the, you know, lockdowns and everything, production has slowed down even for television shows and even in other countries. But the other way is to go and basically localize, meaning dub or, you know, put the subtitles on some television shows that have been before that just popular in the countries of origin. That's why you see so many of international shows, to my great joy, because, you know, a lot of international shows are much, much, much better than the American stuff because they're just much more interesting, much more colorful and talk about their cultures.
Right.
In fact, I wanted to recommend something that is not American. So to your Korean show, Mr. Sunshine, I am going to pit it against a show. There's actually two shows. They are both British. The first series ran in between 1991 and 96, which was called Prime Suspect, which was one of the most famous British television shows in the history of British cinema. And then they have done like a prequel with the same character as a young person. That show is called Tennyson and ran between 2003 and 2006. The Prime Suspect, the 1991-96 TV show, starred Helen Mirren, who is probably known to almost everybody as a theatrical star, as she won an Oscar for The Queen, as Queen of England, and she's been in dozens of fantastic movies, and she's one of those actors that when she's in a movie, then never mind what the movie is, the movie's probably going to be good because she's in it.
Right.
This is Gene Hackman was the kind of actor. You know, there's several actors who basically, no matter what the movie is, they just make it better. So Helen Mirren starred in that TV show as a police detective woman, if you like, who is a kind of newly appointed inspector, if you like, or the boss of a crime investigation unit. And the problem is that she's the only woman surrounded by men. And yes, she has to catch a suspect, but at the same time, she has to combat all kinds of, from negative reactions, from disrespect to pure sabotage, from her male boss, from her colleagues, from her subordinates, you name it. Everybody would be treating her much better if she was a man, but she's not one of the guys. She's a woman, and she has to win their respect and approval and promotion and access to evidence and access to cases and everything by being much better than everybody else around. So you see her.
It sounds like my life on Wall Street.
Well, that's what I'm saying, that, you know, this is any woman.
You're always getting your partners trying to sabotage you and have you mess up so they can, you know, take your clients, take your business.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's that. The cases that she has to solve, you know, if anybody likes crime shows, and I watch a lot of them, then obviously the cases are also very interesting and, you know, how she discovers the culprit. But obviously the reason that show was so celebrated because it was saying kind of belatedly in 1990s that look what women had to put up with just to get to their desk, so to speak. The show has won every single possible award on the planet, was one of the most famous, or at least in Europe or in England, the show has been extremely famous and has been running on streaming platforms for quite a while. And then because that show was so beloved, there is a prequel about the same character. The name of the character is Jane Tennyson. So in Prime Suspect, this is played by Helen Mirren. In the Tennyson, this is played by Stephanie Martin, a young actress who basically shows Jane Tennyson at the beginning of her career when she's just like uniformed constable at the very bottom of the ladder. She deals with exactly the same problems of, you know, it is a male environment and they just have a woman. This is in 1970s. That's where the show is set up. She's the bright, hardworking, dedicated policewoman, if you like. And obviously she has to overcome her family, her mother, who obviously who just wants her to be a nice girl in a pretty dress and get married and get settled. Her colleagues who obviously think that she's the lowest and the lowest and the only thing they can do with her is some crude jokes. And again, she has to win the respect of everybody at a huge price to herself at every corner. And that show was shot in early 2000s, so 10 years later, so it's a little bit more modern in the way that the story is told. I think even though there is hardly any family, because the poor character, Jane Tennyson, does not really have a family, because whenever she tries to have a family, everything falls apart, because juggling professional career and home life is almost impossible, even now, much less then. But it is kind of like a saga, and it shows you the changing, or maybe not changing, social issues that are faced by women, but also by men, because not all the men are difficult in that setting. Some of them are helping her with her career or supporting her, but there's a price to pay for that as well. So I just think it's something to be highly recommended.
It's funny, one of my favorite crime series is Wallander. Mm-hmm. And there are several different Wallanders, but I'm thinking of the one that was, it's a BBC filmed in, but it's filmed in Sweden, I think.
You mean the one with Kenneth Branagh, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love it. And he's a very intuitive person. And all the other people he works with are sort of very explicit. And so if you look at his Myers-Briggs profile, he's a very different profile than all the other characters, and they're always getting angry at him. But he's always solving the crime because he makes these huge intuitive leaps. He's just deeply intuitive, and it frustrates everybody around him. And it's a perfect example of, of somebody being incredible in that role, but just constantly running into all sorts of interpersonal challenges. Anyway, you can see why being a major crime inspector is a very hard job.
No, it's absolutely impossible, I think. By the way, Wallander has two other versions. One is obviously the original Swedish one, which is pretty good. And then there is, again, a prequel that's called Young Wallander. That's what they do a lot with those shows.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty good, yeah.
You know, they got the, you know, intuitive guy irritating everybody. That thing right in Young Wallander. So here's my question for you, Nina, because you have such a fantastic grasp on the whole world of movie making and entertainment. Why are the Brits so good? Why do the Brits just come up, you know, century after century with unbelievable theater?
Well,
I used to finish watching a season of Downton Abbey and think, how do they do it? It's unbelievable.
Well, there is something to say about 1,000 years of education versus 200 years of education and the quality thereof. I'm sorry to say. I mean, what can I tell you? You know, a normal, regular European, whether it's in Britain, in Denmark, Bulgaria, or Portugal, it doesn't matter which of the European countries. You know, when you go to school, you get 10 years of geography, 10 years of history, 6 or 7 years of chemistry and physics, a year of astronomy, probably Latin, and a foreign language for 12 years, and so on and so on. This is the normal European education in a normal public school in a small town or a village. I'm not even talking about the elite schools. That's what every European starts the world with when you turn 19 or 18, because that's when you graduate a year later than in the United States. This is what a normal person, whether they were, you know, even if they were an average student, this is the baggage with which they start thinking about the world and therefore thinking about, that's before going to university. So when you come with that amount of education, when you become a screenwriter or an actor or a production designer or any of the crafts that go into making a TV show or a movie, you start from a different educational perch, if you like, than when you start in the United States and you got, you know, whatever education you got. The United States, as you know, has fantastic preschools and great universities and a huge hole in the middle called 12 years of I don't know what, but
right,
not greatest, not comparable to European. And I think what makes it a difference, I mean, for the acting, actors in England usually come through doing a lot of theater and they go to either Lambda or RADA, you know, one of these great acting schools, where something like your favorite Shakespeare, for example, is required. You have to be able to be a good theater actor before you become a film actor. They all go back between wonderful theater and television shows or movies.
Mm-hmm.
So the training for an actor is completely different. It's much more intellectual and much more deep. The same applies, you know, to a director of photography or production designer or a costume designer. You know, these are the people who study the stuff. Hollywood obviously sucks in a lot of British or European talent, as you know.
Right.
But sometimes it's not enough because a decision maker in a place like BBC is someone who has the same education and he would support, you know, a show like Downton Abbey with a lot of love and care because, well, there's also public funding, you know, don't get me even started on this. Everywhere in Europe, in every country, the government actually supports quality television and quality filmmaking through grants, through the national funds, through, you know, a lot of mechanisms that are in place. So if you want to do something about the life of Shakespeare, you're not going to have, you know, a hotshot Hollywood executive saying, well, no, Shakespeare doesn't sell, I don't want to do it.
Right.
There is no such supports in Hollywood. It's all capitalist, if you like, you know, whatever is commercial, that what sells, but no one is going to go for an art house film. So the main source of quality television or art house films is unfortunately during today's economics or, yeah, it's all about money as always, right?
Well, so the BBC receives a fee from every British citizen, correct? So you've got a, yeah.
Yeah, you pay the television license, but there's also, you know, there are direct funds that go through the Ministry of Culture, Ministry of Education, whatever it's called in every single European country, there is some kind of a film fund that is directly paid for by the government in spades. So, you know, you always get grants from the government, especially if it's something of a national value. So if you want to make a movie about, I don't know, Henry VIII, you probably will get funds because they know that if it's a movie about, you know, two people robbing a bank, the filmmakers can actually get funding from the commercial television, let's say ITV, right? Or even Hollywood backing or something. But if they want to do something that is non-commercial, they have to get the support of the government, and they do get it. I'm simplifying enormously.
Right.
The very complex issue, but this is the fundamental difference between Europe and United States, if you like, or Hollywood.
So one of the things I do want to say is if you look at these sagas, you know, in combination, we live in a society where there's extraordinary sort of video theater available to us.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would say Yellowstone, Mr. Sunshine, Battlestar Galactica, Prime Suspect, Outlander, Downton Abbey, you're talking about, you know, one excellent production after another. So it is Thanksgiving time, so we have something to give thanks for here. And because I think it's very extraordinary. I would note that I went to see what was ranked on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And in the top 20 or 30 links under videos or movies, Yellowstone had about 10 or 15, you know, because you have different packaging and combinations. But basically, Yellowstone was just, you know, it was Yellowstone, 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 and yet not one Emmy for Yellowstone. And I thought, wow.
Yeah, but we had to touch upon this, you know, the whole award circuit, the way things are voted for and nominated or whatever, is not necessarily reflective of the commercial viability or popularity of anything. In fact, sometimes we talked about it that for films, it's just the reverse.
Right.
The stuff that gets awarded very often is very non-commercial, and everything that is very commercial will never be awarded any prestigious awards, because the critical acclaim and the commercial popularity are really two different things for various reasons. It's too complex to discuss, but I wouldn't worry about that. But I would say that people are smart, and they know that they can find various lists on the internet that would recommend to them things that are satisfying, because we always want to have both of the worlds. So, for example, the shows that we are recommending, at the same time that they have extreme entertainment value, they are not boring, they are, you know, they're just great entertainment, great fun. And they have various values that are much more, you know, they're high quality productions with a lot of care that went into the writing of them and acting and so on. So I would not worry about Emmys too much. I would worry more about, Emmys are important because they sometimes highlight some very important shows that are important simply to watch, or they reflect popularity for some other reasons. But we went for sagas on screen or historical stories. So, you know, our list is something different. We're trying to get
right
both worlds at the same time, right? Fun,
right,
and something deeply educational. And
well,
I don't know if you've noticed, but you know what my phrase is going to be. You know what the phrase is going to be?
Yeah, we've wasted a perfectly good hour.
Exactly. We have just run out of time. But I think that we have at least highlighted one or two shows for somebody who hasn't been familiar with them, as the possibility to spend long November and December nights binging on something that is
delicious,
intellectually satisfying. Yes, delicious, intellectually satisfying. My requirement is always, does it entertain the mind? And I wanted to thank you.
Well, but I've discovered Prime Suspect, because, you know, I haven't seen that yet. So now I've got a new one.
And I have to see Battlestar Galactica, because I think I just watched one show of something that maybe not, it wasn't even that serious. So we both have recommendations for ourselves. We took care of ourselves, but hopefully also we're taking care of our listeners. And again, I would like to thank you very much for your recommendations and chatting with me.
Thank you. Thank you, Nina. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Goodbye.